want the roster of the Pima Municipal Soccer League. It's a list that occurs with some variation at a great many places in the Pima Municipal literature. There was a question last time about who these, about the identity of these peoples who were here prior to the emergence of ancient Israel. Joshua 3:10 lists lists seven names, this list recurs, as I said, with a number of variations. But the principal cast of characters is here. The term Canaanites refers, of course, to the indigenous population of the area at the beginning of the biblical tradition, therefore, at least by the time of the beginning of the Middle Bronze Age. The name perhaps stems from, if we take the lead from the ancient Greeks who called these people the Phoenicians, the name may refer to their manufacture of purple dye from the murex shell, which they exported to all parts of the ancient world. Therefore, it is possible that the Canaanites were the first purple people of history. The second name here, Hittites, of course, I'm sure is familiar to most of us. The Hittite Empire in Asia Minor was a wide-ranging empire in the middle centuries of the second millennium BC, modern Turkey. Hivites, the name is possibly connected with a site, Kue in Cilicia, that is southern, southwestern, I guess we'd say southeastern and south central Anatolia. This name often alternates in the Hebrew and the Greek texts with the term I put in parentheses here, Horites, who are known from extra-biblical, or rather the same name occurs in extra-biblical material as Hurrians, people of Huru. They were the creators of a rather wide-ranging empire. Centered on the middle Euphrates, centering in the area of the biblical Haran, area known in the Bible as Haran, an empire which was at its height in the middle centuries of the second millennium BC. These people spoke a non-Semitic and non-Indo-European language. They are not to be confused, and the same term seems also to be applied in another sense to cave dwellers over here in southern Transjordan in a number of texts, but they are not the same Hurrian peoples, almost certainly. The term Perizzites is one of the more obscure. It may be an ethnic designation having a Hurrian derivation, or it may be simply a term for the village populace, that is, villagers. The term Girgashites has cognate, which has appeared in Ugaritic and in Egyptian texts from the late Bronze Age, but still not in texts which are otherwise very obscure, and so this term is still not definable. Amorites means etymologically Westerners. It's a term first applied from the Mesopotamian or Babylonian perspective to peoples inundating the entirety of the Fertile Crescent in the early centuries of the second millennium BC, and that period, toward the end of that period that is still very little known, between the period of transition from early bronze to middle bronze born. A great many Amorite kingdoms were formed in the early centuries of the second millennium BC. The famous kingdom of Mari in the 18th century was one of them. And there were, according to the biblical tradition, Amorite kings over here in northern Jordan in the in period prior to the beginning of the biblical tradition here. The term Jebusites is the name for the early inhabitants of Jerusalem. So this catalog of seven nations is an indication that there was already in the this narrow corridor between the desert and the sea a highly mixed population by the beginning of the late Bronze Age. And in fact, as I think I suggested in the first lecture, many of the names of the rulers of these city-states scattered throughout the corridor and on up to, into Syria in the Amorna letters have non-Semitic names. The first half of the second millennium was an age of the emergence of great empires, and the middle centuries of that millennium was the beginning of their decline. And this narrow corridor between the desert and the sea was, in fact, a happy hunting ground for the spin-off of many of those conflicts at the greater power centers in the first half of the second millennium. Today, tonight, and that is, I hope, will be helpful background to what we will be doing this evening. Now, I'll turn this light off and switch. If you have a lot of it, you'll still be able, I hope, to read the handouts. Our focus for this evening is the site of the ancient city of Shechem and the biblical traditions regarding early Israel's its role in the emergence of premonarchical Israel. In the story of the premonarchical period, we've been looking at Joshua and Judges, and we've seen that the book of Joshua, which purports to claim a conquest of the entirety of Palestine west of the Jordan and a good part of and presupposes the prior conquest of a good part of this side, so that in Joshua 11 we have the very sweeping claim that Joshua took all that land. The hill country, and all the Negev, and all the land of Goshen, and the lowland, and the Arabah, and the hill country of Israel, and its lowland, from Mount Halak, in the valley of that rises towards Seir, down here in southern Transjordan, as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, below Mount Hermon. And he took all those kings, and smote them, and put them to death. That's a very sweeping editorial claim, wrapping up the conquest, or rather the warfare segment of the book, the first 11 chapters. Well, as you know, we are almost to the end of chapter 8, and we have had only three battles thus far, and one of them was a resounding defeat. So there is a strong tension between the content of the warfare stories and the sweeping editorial claims of the later monarchical editor of that material, who wanted to present those stories as the basis for the later monarchical claim. Well, Josh was going to have to hurry up in chapters 9 and 10 and 11 to make good on that rather sweeping editorial claim. It's very interesting, therefore, that following the second story of the second battle for the ruin, in chapter 8, that instead of proceeding to more warfare, at the very end of that chapter, they go to a valley situated between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. This is a very strategically located mountain, a pass through the central hill country, about midway between Jerusalem, 40 miles, well, more than it is, 40 miles north of Jerusalem, The most important pass from the coastal plain into the Jordan Valley via either a pass living directly that way or up into the Wadi Farah coming down into the Jordan. The most important pass through the north central hill country between Jerusalem in the south and the Mount Carmel Spur, the edge of the Israeli plain in the north. Pass flanked by Mount Ebal on the north and Mount Gerizim on the south. Oops, that didn't work. That will. Here we are looking into the pass from the east, looking west out toward the Mediterranean. The wooded slope of Mount Gerizim coming down from the south. Wooded now thanks to extensive reforestation since Mandate days. The naked slopes of Mount Ebal coming down from the north. Mount Gerizim was probably wooded in antiquity. Mount Ebal has probably always been pretty much denuded because the bedding plains over there tilt away to the north, and therefore there's not much moisture contained for vegetation on the southern slopes of Mount Ebal. We're about a kilometer or so east of the Tell, which nestles between the feet of the two mountains. The Tell itself is about 2 miles this side of the city of Nablus, the Naples, the Napoli of the East, founded as a successor to Shechem by the Emperor Vespasian in 72 AD. You turn around and walk to the Tell. We have a very strategically located mound, literally guarding the pass from the desert, or from the sea, into the Jordan Valley. Cherie wants to see some famous people here. Now, this is the staff in 1957, digging at you. Here's the Tell in the foreground. Mount Gerizim coming down to the left, Mount Ebal coming down to the right. Nablus is out of view behind the Tell. Here is the lecturer and his spouse. Here are Paul and Nancy Lapp. Jonas Wright, the archaeological director. Bernard Anderson, the administrative director. Ovid R. Sellers, predecessor of ours at McCormick. And I'm trying to find Professor Campbell. Here he is. Edward F. Campbell. Any others there that you care to know about? Larry Toombs, Robert Boyle. I think that pretty much.
That's good.
Here we're looking out west toward the Mediterranean, doing it about face from the mound. If you were to proceed directly to the east, you'd move through a pass in the other side of the valley, which is about 5 miles broad here and about 5 miles long. One of only two such broad and fertile valleys interrupting the spiny backbone of the country between Jerusalem and the plain of Israel. So the plain is about 5 miles wide and a little over 5 miles long. You can go due west, or due east rather, down to the Jordan Valley, or if you can head to the north east, you pick up eventually the Wadi Farah at the head of the Wadi, which then goes down to the Jordan Valley. At the head of the Wadi Farah is Tel Farah, site of ancient Tirzah. More about that later, just about 5 miles away from our site of Shechem. Back on the mound, if you look out to the southeast, you're looking now, this is partway up the slopes of Ebal. You're looking down at the excavated mound, Tel Balata, the slopes of Gerizim coming down here. This large rectangular area is a refugee camp, and this is the southern part. You can almost see the southern limit of the plain before you have to climb up into the limestone hills again to make your way south to Jerusalem. It's a small mound by standards that we were talking about last week, 13 and a half acres. That makes it roughly 13 and a half acres. That makes it just a little bit larger than a tiny mound. It was mightily fortified, however, and throughout the middle and late Bronze Age, it was the most strongly fortified city between Jerusalem and Gezer here in the south, and Ta'anak and Megiddo on the southern flank of the Mount Carmel, or on the Mount Carmel spur, flanking the south side of the Esdraelon plain. So it is realistically estimated that throughout the Middle Bronze and Late Bronze Age, Shechem, this a small fortified site that we're talking about, effectively controlled roughly 1,000 square miles in the central country. Some biblical names are associated still with things in the area. The dome here covers a little shrine called Kubr Yusuf, the tomb of Joseph. Shechem is associated with the stories of the patriarchs, Abraham's first stop as he comes into the country, according to the tradition, is to pasture his flocks in the fields near Shechem. Bones of Joseph were brought back from Egypt, according to the tradition, and buried near Shechem. In the modern village of, in the modern village of Palatza, at the foot of the mound, and which actually spills up over onto the mound and partly obscures it, so much so, in fact, that the site was not identified as ancient Shechem until as late as 1903. The reason being that the modern village spills up over onto the mound from the south, obscuring the contours of a striking tell, such as you see elsewhere. But in the modern, or in the village of Palatza, you can go into an unfinished, the shell of an unfinished Orthodox church, and be shown Jacob's Well, Deir Yaakov, which figures in one of the New Testament stories. Here is an aerial view, and I'll leave this on the screen while we look at the handouts. But this is the excavated area of the mound. Most of the excavation is concentrated here. This is the village of Palatza obscuring much of the mound. If you look at the handouts, which I have distributed, first the larger one in the upper right-hand corner, we have a plan of Shechem showing the excavated areas across the top half of the semicircle and the projected line of the rest of the city wall across the bottom. And you can see the outlines of village houses showing the march of the village up the hill. Shechem was, as I said, first identified in 1903, and modern excavations there began in 1913 and 14, under the direction of Ernst Selin. He worked there briefly. In 1913 and 14, and then more extensively again in 1926 and 27. There was no little friction and controversy within the German institution sponsoring the dig, and after 1927, Selin, who was a biblical scholar, was made subordinate to Gabriel Welter, a classical archaeologist and architect. Selin and Welter, then was in charge from 1928 on into the early 30s. And throughout those seasons of excavations, they moved tons and tons of dirt. They employed many, many workers with far from adequate supervision, even by the standards of the day. It was a very sketchy publication of the results. And Celine's nearly finished manuscript of the entire excavation, together with a lot of the smaller finds and artifacts, was destroyed in the Allied bombing in Berlin. The results of the German excavations were to uncover large areas of architecture, very little of which, however, could be confidently dated. And because of the history of the expedition riddled with controversy, the Germans were no longer interested in resuming the excavation of the place. So in 1954 and 55, Ernest Wright of McCormick Seminary and Bernard Anderson of Drew University organized an expedition which expanded, which was known originally as the Drew McCormick Expedition, expanded to include the sponsorship and participation of a great many other institutions, and known therefore as the Joint Expedition to Tell the Lata, beginning in 1956 with a brief season, a full season in 57, and then beginning in 1966, beginning in 1960, from 1960 to 1968, from alternate seasons digging there. The idea was to try to make as much sense with careful stratigraphical reporting out of what had already been uncovered, and by digging in previously untouched areas to bring to bear the correctives that would enable us to make better historical reconstruction with a minimum of investment and of new excavation. It's an extremely important city. Albrecht Dalt, another great German scholar, in the wake of the early German excavations, lamented the fact that things had not come out better than they did, because he considered Shechem to be the uncrowned queen of Palestine. It certainly is very important in the biblical tradition, as we've seen the first. After the stories of Jericho and Ai, the next thing that is inserted is a visit to the Shechem, what is in fact the Shechem Valley, for a ceremony of blessings and curses, as it is described there at the end of Joshua 8. That is to say, for a ceremony of covenanting, of treaty making with divine participation. That's the brief notes. At the end of the book of Joshua, after all of the fighting and dividing of the land, we have a whole chapter given to an account of such a covenant making, or treaty making, at Shechem. And so this, and there is no conquest story as such anywhere in the book of Joshua. This old and extremely important site produced no conquest story. How's come? And yet in the next era, in the book of Judges, in chapter 9, we read about the son of one of the famous saviors of Israel, Gideon, one of the judges, his son, by a concubine from Shechem, goes to Shechem, has himself proclaimed king of the city-state, at the same time that he functions as field commander of the Israel militia, the popular militia of the tribal organization. It lasts for only 3 years. The local support for his monarchy collapses, and he winds up using according to the story, using the people's militia to thoroughly destroy the city of Shechem and soil with salt. That is basic under a dramatic sign of infertility. And yet Shechem does not die. At the end of the first great period of monarchy in the 10th century, at the death of Solomon, the 10 larger tribes, larger and more prosperous tribes, have had enough of the Jerusalem style of kingship that they break away and create a monarchy of their own. And so from 922 on, the death of Solomon, we have a history in parallel columns. The so-called northern kingdom called Israel, and the southern kingdom with its capital in Jerusalem. And Shechem becomes the first capital of the northern kingdom after the, according to the tradition, after the split of Solomon's death. Doesn't stay there very long, moves very quickly in the reign of the first king, Jeroboam. It moves across the Jordan River to Penuel, which is most likely that Tallulah Dahab, which David mentioned earlier, and which we will be visiting on the field trip this Friday. Didn't stay there very long, came back to the West Bank, to what the capital did, to the site of Tirzah, which I mentioned, Tel El Farah, some 5 miles northeast of Jerusalem, all within the early years of the Northern Kingdom. But then in the 9th century, the great Omri dynasty, Kings Omri and Ahab, secured and built de novo, built from scratch, the city of Samaria, located about 5 miles west of Shechem, through that pass on the western flank of Mount of the Ebal Range, so that from the mid-9th century on, Samaria becomes the capital city of the northern kingdom. Shechem, in other words, had an extremely important role in the pre-monarchical period and in the early monarchical period, but was also very quickly abandoned by the northern monarchical establishment. So here was a city which could be easily excavated, a site which could be easily excavated as a site which would also serve as a field training base for a new generation of archaeologists, Wright and Anderson hoped and believed. So we were there. I was there off and on for 3 seasons, but the Drew McCormick joint expedition was there, as I've indicated, from 1956 to 1968, working mostly in alternate seasons under Jordanian license. I think that the best way to get a fix on the results of the excavations and in relation to the biblical tradition is to talk first about the history of the defensive system, the fortifications of the city, say something about the history of cultic institutions, the temple, the great temple area within the city, and then add some footnotes to that and turn back to the biblical material. So the first thing is to look again at this larger handout, at the plan in the upper right-hand corner, and let me point out several things on it. In the upper left-hand quadrant, you have a piece of city wall and a triple entry city gate. Does everybody see it? That piece of wall, defensive wall, in the northwest quadrant, the upper left-hand corner, is now known as Wall A, and it connects with the north, what we call the northwest gate, northwest entrance into the city. It was traced, that entire strip of wall, and it was traced by the German excavators. The city gate was uncovered by them, and it was left open for, obviously, a number of decades where its nicely shaped building stones were easily mined for neighboring constructions, and so there was not much left of it when the joint expedition returned. So this plan is based, this part of the plan is based largely, but not entirely, on the earlier German excavations. Over in the, yes?
I have a bit of a problem with the gate being defensive, and it looks to me like one could go straight through.
Exactly. It was not a very, we'll see some, I have some good illustrations of the other gate, and you'll see how it was built and what its weaknesses were. You did, you went straight through it. Over on the eastern, northeastern quadrant, you see another stretch of city wall connecting with still another city gate. Okay, this is the east gate, and this stretch of defensive wall coming down from the north to connect with it is called Wall B, just to get ourselves oriented. Now back to the other quadrant, just inside Wall A you see a temple, rectangular temple area. And out in front of that, an L-shaped piece of wall, that I will be referring to as Wall 900. And we'll see it in the section on the other page. Everybody see that L-shaped piece of wall out in front of the temple area, to the right of the temple area as you look at it. Okay, back to the upper right-hand quadrant. Where that piece of Wall B begins, you see an excavation trench running across it. That is Field 13. It looks like a 3 in the blurred Xerox copy, but it is really Field 13. I've been making some references to that. Here on the handout, we have in the upper left-hand corner an enlargement of the plan of the Northwest Gate. And it is as Shireen suggests. You entered from off the page and walked between three sets of massive stone piers. These piers were placed in such a way that now, to the history of the fortifications. And for this, the section at the top of the smaller handout will be helpful. This is a cross-section through the western side of the tell, which runs from Wall A through the temple area and runs through that Wall 900, which I mentioned earlier. That Wall 900 is conveniently described as a temenos wall. That is, it encloses, it's part of a wall which once enclosed the sacred area, the temple area. So if you were to draw a line from Wall A through the temple to intersect with that Wall 900, you would have roughly the line of this section, cross-section that is drawn at the top of the smaller handout. The earliest occupation of Shechem is cluster of small chalcolithic encampments right on bedrock, deep beneath the later temple. And you can see that indicated just to the left of Wall D. Not much to be seen there, and nothing in my slides to show you. The Shechem first continuous settlement as a small town at Telgalata was there before what is indicated here as Wall D was built. It's represented by remains which are not drawn but are simply labeled. To the right of Wall D, you see the label remains of MB2A and B. The reason they're not here is that the section doesn't go through them. But this label here corresponds to remains of rather massive platform here at the beginning of, towards the end of, somewhere late in MB2A or early in MB2B.
Wall D is MB2B?
Wall D is MB2B, yes. And the earliest settlement here existed before Wall D was built, and so far as the excavator, as we can tell, was outside any existing fortifications at the time, if Shechem was a walled town at the time. Wall D is the earliest defense wall. So it became a town sometime before the construction of Wall D. Therefore, the first structures were outside any known fortifications, late in MB2A or early 2B, therefore around 1800 to 1750. The next phase of the town's expansion saw the construction of a city wall, which is labeled Wall D, and along with it, the wall, which is labeled 900, that's that L-shaped terminus wall on the top plan, which we were looking at earlier. Wall D is built as a freestanding wall, and it corresponds, it has counterparts at Megiddo and at Tel Beit Mursin from approximately the same period. Freestanding stone wall. Built in about, built clearly in MB2B, as determined by pottery that was pulled out from within it when the section was put through it. The fact that it is a freestanding thing suggests that, but also MB2 suggests that it is still pre-Hyksos. That is to say, prior to the last quarter of the 18th century. Wall D was, Wall 900 was built about the same time, thus enclosing an area inside the city which will go through four major phases, not indicated on the section here, but it will clearly go through four major phases from about 1725 to 1650 with several architectural constants in each of those phases, which led G. Ernest Wright to compare the structures there in that area between Wall D and Wall 900 with a series of Hittite temples excavated at the Hittite capital in Lulispoy, and which he labeled courtyard temples. Question?
Yes. Okay, Wall D is founded on bedrock.
Yes.
And the surfaces that go with Wall D also go with Wall 900.
Some of them do, yes.
Okay. And the dates begin with 2 and 8.
Right.
All right. To the left. The
calcolithic
layers are cut through by Wall D.
Exactly. I was sure that somebody was going to spot that. This is based upon the old German section.
Okay. Marl. Untested.
At this point.
Is that
that mean mud brick? Does that mean little bronze?
That means little bronze.
So we have a little bronze dump on top of the lithic in situ layers according to Celine. Right.
No evidence of EV anywhere on the mound. Anywhere in excavation, or a few scattering of shears. Okay. Nothing much to show you between well D and well 900 because it had been previously excavated, recorded, and covered up before I got there with my camera. I simply want to report that this area, what you notice, is under the forecourt of the later Middle Bronze Age temple. Had an architectural history which Wright thought corresponded to courtyard temple style, which is known now from the Hittite capitals. This part of his reconstruction is still being contested. I'm not ready to fight and die for it, but I want to report it out and move on. The next phase of the city's expansion in history is represented by the construction of Wall C out here to the left of the section, next to the last wall on the left. You see retaining wall C, and behind it, a massive earthen fill, dirt which has been brought down from slopes of Ebal, and actually this mound sits on the outer extremity of the lower slopes of Ebal, so that the northern side of the city was always higher than the southern side, except for massive filling operations, which virtually every period of rebuilding in the city saw. At the time that the Tingling Wall C was built, it was built to hold a massive earthen embankment behind it, an embankment that was nearly 100 feet wide, beneath what would later become the temple sitting up there on top of it. This embankment is found also in field 13 and in field and another field which I didn't point out to you between the northwest gate and field 13. So it looks for all the world like a part of a massive embankment which once encircled the mound and corresponds to a kind of fortification which is seen elsewhere in the country, and which is often associated with the arrival of the Hyksos in the late 18th century BC. A massive earthen embankment at Tatsuro is a classic example, but we saw in the slides of Jericho last week evidences of a comparable Middle Bronze Age construction at Jericho, in which there was a stone retaining wall farther down the slope, retaining open back in place, a massive fill, and this smaller screening wall and at the top of the MB fortifications. So the wall C business and the embankment behind it are dated to early Hyksos period, not merely on the basis of parallels with things elsewhere, but on the basis of pottery. But you see, with the addition of Wall C and the embankment, both Wall D and 900 are now clearly inside the city's defenses. Wall D had been the defense wall at an earlier period. By this time, we are well into a period in which Shechem is being referred to in extra-biblical sources. A couple of references from Egyptian documents in the reign of Sesostris III. Pharaoh Sesostris III in the 19th century, mention of Shechem, and also mentioned in some of the roughly comparable execration texts from Egypt. The next stage, and one of which the Middle Bronze Age fortification system is finally set in its widest limits, involved the construction of Wall A, relay system, built massive stones, some of them more than 2 meters in length, roughly 7 feet long, therefore nicknamed by the people who were described as the Cyclopean Wall. Many of the Cyclops stones. A massive thing which stood still preserved to a height of 30 feet when Ehrenstreich walked around it in 1934. Its top, as you see from the section, is a battered wall. That is to say, it slopes inward on the outside, on the exterior face, although it was built as a freestanding wall, as you can see from the strictly perpendicular interior face. It's battered. The top of it is about a meter and a half off the vertical. But it was built then to hold in place a massive fill, which was thrown in behind it in order to support defensive structures on top of it and the temple, and in order to produce the what became the platform of the Great New Bronze Age Temple. So the walleye system went on around as far as the east gate. We'll say more of it about it over there in a moment, but included the triple entry northwest gate, which was a massive structure about 52 and a half feet wide by 59 feet deep, but not very wisely designed, as Shuey observed. There were flanking towers, at least a couple of stories high, and casemate constructions inside the wall, which might be used for storage or battlement platforms. This walleye system, we can confidently say, was added late in NB2C, say 1600 to 1550. It's a late Hyksos period addition to the defensive system. Not long after it was completed, it was supplemented by the addition of the wall B system and the east gate. The wall B system running around the northern and eastern stretches of the mound as far as the east gate. Very different kind of wall, as we will see. It's built, it's about 12 meters or 11 meters wide. Or is it feet? I think it's feet. Built in inset-offset patterns, so it's not a continuous line, but bends with the contours of the mound, and connects up with the east gate, which was a smaller and still weaker construction involving only two sets of piers between which you passed in order to enter the city. This is founded on a higher level than the wall A system is. We have in the middle of the larger handout here a reconstruction of what the northwest gate and the wall A system might very well have looked like at the time of its construction. But around the city, on the other side, at the east gate, we have a double wall system, wall A at the bottom and wall B up above, and the east gate goes only through wall B. So we must assume that there was a roadway running south from the east gate and downhill to pass through a still undiscovered south gate or southeast gate or southwest gate through wall A. The reason for this double wall system on the north was that the city was always higher on that side and more easily accessible. And so the fortification system was strengthened on the north, from the north, the northwest gate, where you see the wall B coming off the diagram, off the plan there, and connecting up with, wall B connects up with the east gate, but in the field of the east gate, wall A is 11 meters out in front of wall B, and it's deep down, and it goes way down because there was a valley there at that point, which had to be filled up and blocked over. And in field 13, wall A was found exactly 11 meters out in front of wall B. So we know that there was this double wall system with an embankment between them, enclosing the northern part of the mound, Shri.
Any of the excavations, any evidence of warfare during the Middle
Bronze period? Yes, we'll get to that.
And we have destruction
there
too.
Yes. Okay, and down here in the lower left-hand corner of the larger handout then is an isometric sketch of the first phase of the East Gate. Now, we're going to get to the slides here in a moment. What else do I need to report on? Wall B then, on the north and east and the east gate, was added to strengthen the defenses on the high side. There must be another gate undiscovered because it is buried now between beneath the modern village of Alata, covering the southern part of the mound. So let's look at the next segment slides very quickly. Here is the north, here is that massive wall A, the northwest gate, wall A continuing here, and you have to use your imagination to see wall B continuing off the inner portion here. The northwest gate is somewhere over here in the trees, but it will be very clear as we proceed. This is a close-up of the wall B system, wall A system rather, where it intersects with the northwest gate. If I were standing down here, I would be about so high. Massive thing, with carefully constructed drains in the face of it. The largest of these stones, as I said, is about 7 feet long. This, I don't know what happened here, but this building, oh, we'll see the slides later. It was topped in antiquity by a brick and timber superstructure. It stands, it stood here in 1934 to a height of about 30 feet. It was topped by a massive brick and mud brick and timber superstructure, which when the city was, when the wall was destroyed, fell into the city for a distance of 50 feet. So it was a massive thing. And we can imagine that the brick, superstructure of the wall extended on up for another, at least another 30 feet. Massive. This is the east gate. You entered from down the slope, or from down, coming up from the south, turned left, passing through, passing between two pairs of massive basalt piers. Nearly, they're a meter and a half, 2 meters high. I should be able to give you the exact dimensions, but I can't. Went down a series of steps into the city. These piers were apparently placed in such a way that either doors slid between them to close in the center on wooden or stone rollers, or else timbers were lowered between them. We have no evidence, as far as I know, in antiquity of the portcullis gate, do we? It goes up and down, as in the stereotypical picture of a medieval castle. No evidence of that sort of thing. So how these gates functioned, how they were closed, is something of a puzzle. but they were vulnerable to battering rams and fire. The piers flanked guard, or rather the gate was flanked by guardrooms on either side, and support, here's and supported a massive structure above, probably two, at least a second, and probably more than that stories above it. Here are the stone steps leading down into the city, worn very little, so that, and these were added in the, as you can see in a later phase, the entryway is beginning, late in the Middle Bronze Age, the entryway is beginning to fill up. The stones were little worn, and so this final phase did not last long before it was destroyed. Here is the only piece of wall B that I can show you. We did not re-excavate the German trench here, but it is a series of offset inset segments made of much smaller stones than wall A. Wall A would be down the slope here, about 11 meters out in front of this one. Here are some sections of that mud brick wall toppled from the mud brick superstructure of the wall toppled into the city, posing something of a puzzle to geodestroid on the left and fall off on the right. Here is, you can see other sections of the massive sections of the wall toppled far into the city proper when the city was destroyed at least twice within a period of not more than 10 or 15 years in the middle centuries of the 16th century, say 1550 to 1540 BC. The temple, as previously excavated by the German expeditions, as we, expedition, as we found in 1956 and 57. A massive thing, and the first building of its sort uncovered in the corridor. A massive thing, 21 meters by 26 meters in diameter, with walls 5.3 meters thick. That's over 15, almost 16 feet thick, the walls of this building. It was built, or here's the southern wall, face the southern wall after we cleared it up, with the walls of another building sitting on top of it, as you can see here. Was built in, well, built contemporary with the wall A system. That much is clear. Both contemporary with the wall A system, a massive building which could serve both as a fortress and as a temple. Out in front of it now, down here is that, and here are some of the remains of that so-called courtyard temple area, which preceded the construction of wall D, which runs deep under the forecourt of the temple. This is fill which the expedition put back in here after digging and reporting the site and building this retaining wall to support it in order to put to set up again a massive standing stone. This is not where it was found. It was found previously by the German excavators and left in a dump. By a piece of stenographic detective work, which may not be absolutely dead right, but has a lot to suggest it. It belongs to a still later phase of the temple. The earlier, the second phase of this big temple here had smaller stones comparable to this flanking the entrance on either side. Here's the, this one was broken off by the German excavators. And this is the foundation shaft for a second one, flanking the entrance to the second phase of this building, which is, a top plan of which is, well, the smaller handout, showing the earlier phase, the first rectangular phase with the massive walls in solid lines. That phase of the thing went through, built in a period contemporary with wall A, went through a remodeling in a period contemporary with the wall B system, in which the entrance was partially closed up, moved to the left, and at that period, presumably, these two standing stones, these two sacred pillars, were positioned in a place which would flank the later, the second phase of the narrower entrance to the fortress temple. This one was destroyed at the same time as the east gate and the wall B defense system in late MB2C, at the end of MB2C. The sacred area, however, did not go out of use, nor did the wall system entirely. Well, this is how I got that previous picture. This is not myself on the ladder, but I decided to imitate the expedition's photographer, and I decided after once doing that that I would never aspire to being an expedition photographer. Here's a close-up of that. That pillar is almost 2 meters high. And in, on the smaller handout here, as I said, when this thing was discovered, there were no known parallels for it in the corridor. It has subsequently been compared to one which was found at Megiddo. They must be Megiddo excavators dated to the late Bronze Age, which Wright thinks he did, Wright argued, and I think convincingly, belonged to the earlier Middle Bronze Age period, contemporary with the one which has almost identical plan at Galata. At the lower, at the bottom of the smaller handout, then we have an artist's reconstruction of what Fortress Temple looked like in the first period, in the 1A period, prior when it had the wider entrance, prior to the partial closing of that entrance, and prior to the setting up of the two smaller sacred pillars to flank the smaller entrance. Now, I don't know why I returned to this slide at this point. Oh, I know why I did. And that was to orient you to Field 13, but we'll come to that in a moment. The sacred area continued in use in the late Bronze Age period after a gap of almost a century. LB1 is missing on the mound almost completely. From about 1540 to 1450. A most impressive gap. Although, incidentally, since the expedition has concluded, some minerals which have plowed into an LB, a very massive LB1 tomb on Mount Carasim. But no evidence anywhere of occupation or the tell in LB1. However, in LB2, 14th century, the town is flourishing once again. This is the period of the famous Amarna letters, in which the local kings of the various city-states up and down the corridor and far north of Syria are writing home to the Home Office in Egypt. And one of them is the Prince of Shechem, whose name is Labayu. Many of them, as we said, have non-Semitic names. Labayu has a good Semitic name. And Labayu is something of a hooter dealer here in the North Central Hill Country. Other princes write to the Home Office complaining bitterly to him, to Pharaoh about him. He is accused by one of his competitors of having given Shechem to the Habib, to the Apiru, he has a son who is Prince of Pella over here in the northern Jordan Valley, according to the Mormon letters. And this crafty old Prince of Wayu, snug in the LB revival amidst the MB rebel, rules an area, effectively controls an area, as I said earlier, of almost 1,000 square miles here in the north central of the country. It is the only city mentioned, city-state mentioned in the Mormon letters between Jerusalem and Gezer in the south, and Taanach and Megiddo in the north of the Rilo. In the period of revival in LB2, the temple was rebuilt in